This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence newsletter subscribers. Thanks, guys. For more true crime that's worth your time, sign up for the newsletter at bestevidence.fyi. It's just $5 a month or $55 for the annual subscription, although there is a free version. Better yet, give Best Evidence as a gift to the dad or grad in your life, or that lady at your local who won't shut up about Bear Brook. Team that lady, by the way, that pod is the shit. But back to the point, which is sign yourself, your pops, and your pets up at bestevidence.fyi. And now back to the episode, which is starting right now.
And when we all went down there, we went across that big old pipe to that place in Robin Hood Woods they call the Devil's Den. And nobody knows what happened but me.
The Arkansas air is thick with Academy Award winners, and the Dixon, Illinois air is thick with recriminations. We are tackling two cold case properties in today's 100th full-length The Blotter Presents episode, 2013's Devil's Knot, Atom Egoyan's take on the West Memphis 3 case, and All the Queen's Horses, a kind of amateurish documentary about an extremely professional municipal government fraudster. Don't satanic panic, it's The Blotter Presents, episode 100. Hundred episodes, you guys. We did it. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, true crime that is hopefully worth your time. Thank you for listening all this time, everyone. Thanks to all my esteemed guests over the months and years. And last but never least, thanks to my guest today, who kindly agreed to celebrate this milestone with me, even though it's his first day at a new job, the one and only Toby Ball. Hi, Toby.
Hey, the centennial celebrations are hopping in Durham.
we're trying. This really is sort of like that June 17th, 1994 documentary where like just everything is happening at once for you today, including NBA playoffs as we record this. So I will try to get you in and out of here in a reasonable amount of time. Let's start with our first cold case. Devil's Knot. This is a feature film, like I said, from 2013. It was on Netflix until, as we're recording this, like this morning. You could still find it on iTunes and Amazon Prime. Toby, I went back and looked at the, you know, gazillion episodes before this one, and I could have sworn we talked about the Paradise Lost documentaries way back in like 2017. Is that?
Yeah, I think we did.
But we didn't. Like I can't find the episode. But that happened.
I think we may have talked about it in the context of something else.
Yeah, possibly.
It might have been. I think we might have. We talked about another one of that guy's documentaries, which I think brought us to talk about that.
Yeah, certainly. Like just searching for Berlinger brought up like. Seriously, 15 episodes. He's really been everywhere. And good for him. But this is, of course, the child murders at Robin Hood Hills, the West Memphis 3 case. Just in case anyone is recently arrived to this genre and is not familiar with the case generally, I'm going to summarize very briefly. From Wikipedia, the West Memphis Three are three men who, as teenagers in 1994, were tried and convicted of the 1993 murders of three boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. Damien Eccles was sentenced to death, Jesse Miss Kelly Jr. to life imprisonment plus two 20-year sentences, and Jason Baldwin to life imprisonment. During the trial, the prosecution asserted that the children were killed as part of a satanic ritual, end quote. Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly were eventually freed thanks to an Alford plea, but the documentaries about their case, the Paradise Lost documentaries I just mentioned, are, if not on the Mount Rushmore of true crime, in the neighboring foothills. Other documentaries and books about the case followed, including Maya Leverett's West of Memphis, which was adapted in 2013 as The Devil's Knot. I think it was called West of Memphis. Am I confusing that with an Elvis biography?
I'm not sure.
It's possible. Anyway, directed by Adam. It's spelled Adam. Pronounced like that. Egoyan, and starring Reese Witherspoon, Colin Firth, Elias Koteas, Bruce Greenwood, Matt Letcher's splendiferous mullet, and others. The film does some things well, but is in the end defeated by the sprawling nature of the material, or at least it was for this correspondent. People unfamiliar with the story might have liked it better. So, Toby, obviously you're quite familiar with this case, generally.
Yes.
Did you, first of all, did you read the book that this was derived from?
No, I didn't. Okay. I mean, I mostly just know from, you know, that documentary.
Right. I did read the book. It's been some years. I don't know why I thought it was West of Memphis. I'm pretty sure that actually is a Elvis biography. It's called Devil's Knot, The True Story of the West Memphis Three. Pardon me, Ms. Leverett. I'm quite familiar with this case. I was like following on Twitter when they were like literally doing the Alfred plea. I was just like sitting on Twitter, refreshing it. And then I was watching it on TV. The thing is that this case, like the documentaries that we were talking about alone, are like 6.5-7 hours of material. There were just ongoing developments for over a decade. Like, I just think that if you're trying to make a 2-hour feature film out of this case, and I've said this about other cases, I think you have to like just slice off a very like narrow slice, or focus on a single person and not try to get your arms around the whole case. And I think this movie sort of tried to do that by focusing on Pam Hobbs, who is the mom of one of the murdered children, but then it kind of like lost control of the desire to make a bunch of points about how dumb Satanic Panic is. I just think it let the size of the and the breadth of the case get away from it. Would you agree with that, Toby?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I agree with you that I think, you know, if you're going to do something like this, especially since, you know, I think people who would naturally be attracted to this movie probably already know a fair amount about the case.
Yeah.
That it probably made more sense to really focus more intensely on one person's experience of it, and so that you don't have to follow every single twist and turn in detail, but that some of that stuff kind of happens off camera. I found it, I don't think it really succeeded at much of anything, but I'm sure we'll explore that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for people who don't know anything about the case, this was, I guess, a diverting 2 hours, but I found it extremely slow going for a number of reasons. One of them was not the depiction of John Mark Byers, who, compared to the Paradise Lost films, is like almost barely in this, but I was quite impressed with what not Kevin Durant, mistake I almost made on Twitter over the weekend, was doing with this role, because John Mark Byers, like, it must have been very difficult to resist doing a just sort of like hacky cornpone imitation of him. And I think Durand is pretty good and relatively subtle. Here is a clip.
That's right. I told him to stay here till I got back. I'd had to punish him for riding a skateboard in the street. Just a couple licks with my belt.
So that was refreshing, because I was like, I was just sort of bracing. Like, Kevin Durand is not a name that you would know, but once you look him up, I think you'll know, you'll recognize him. He was in like Smoke and Aces. He's just like a big galootin dude who tends to play roles like this. So I thought he was good, but there was some acting that was not where it needed to be, perhaps. Did you also find that with certain members of the cast, particularly the kids playing the three? I thought the guy playing Jesse was fine. And then the guy playing Damien was not.
I just, you know, to be honest, and I don't know, like, I think, like, all aspects of it kind of played into it, where I think the acting, like, even where they had, like, you know, really good actors playing roles, and then I think the writing wasn't particularly good, but it's just, and I think, again, with the exception that you were talking about, I just didn't feel like I got much of a sense of any single person beyond, like, it just seems like they were given, like, a one sentence, like, description of their character, and that's what they went off of, because it just, nobody kind of seemed real to me. They all seemed to be sort of types, and
yeah,
and that's particularly frustrating. You know, when you're taking it from life, right? And I think,
sure,
because there's so much other stuff surrounding this case, that what's really the point of making, you know, a dramatic movie about it? And, you know, what are you trying to illuminate by doing this? And I think there's a lot of different ways you could go. I mean, you can,
yeah.
You know, the idea that your kid is horribly murdered, and you know, you don't, you know, there's this prosecution going on of people that you have doubts about, and then you have doubts about all these other men who are in your life, but without having any, like, you have doubts but no real actual suspicions for the most part. And then the whole thing with the investigator, I mean, I think they could have, you know, that's another sort of interesting possibility. But in fact, like, he doesn't really come off as anything. He's just like, he's like obviously kind of driven by crimes he feels are especially heinous. Plus, he's getting divorced, and he's like, his wife tries to do something nice for him, and he's still kind of a dick to her. And that was about the extent of it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't come across as a... And you've got two, like, top, you know, A-level actors in Colm Firth and Reese Witherspoon, who are just, you know, with a lot of possibilities in those characters, and there's just nothing happens. You know, they're absolutely flat.
Well, and I think they had to pick between, like, who do you want to be... sort of the, like, the POV, like, catalyst for your story here, because, like I was saying before, like, it's just too big, so you have to presume a certain amount of knowledge, or don't, but, like, pick the character that you're gonna be on and stay on that character. But I don't think you can do both, like, Pam Hobbs's gradual awakening to the possibility that her husband murdered her son and his friends, or go with this investigator. I mean, either actor is perfectly competent to carry it. I didn't have a problem with either of their performances, especially given some of the garbage writing that they had to deal with. But again, in 2 hours, like, there's just really a lot going on in this case. And unless you sort of are very disciplined about staying on one character, I think it'll just get away from you.
Yeah. The whole thing to me just seemed like kind of a mess. Like, there's so many of these, like, super brief scenes that were trying to, like, kind of bring you up to date with where things were in the trial, or,
yeah,
you know, arrests or whatever. And they go by so fast, and it's like, okay. And then it's on to the next thing. And it's just so clearly you know, that's the only reason why it's there. It doesn't really add anything other than, oh yeah, you should just so you should know, like, this happened.
Yeah, it might have been. I mean, I did sort of like stop paying full attention to it like a third of the way through, because it really was starting to feel a little bit listy, and like some more interesting work got left on the cutting room floor. I will say that this movie is... All right, well, the depiction of Pam Hobbs, like the real life Pam Hobbs, there's this, if you've watched the documentaries, you remember this like footage of her on the news, and she's like holding a refillable Big Gulp, and she's sort of putting her son's Boy Scout neckerchief on her head and being a little bit like, I don't know, flip in a way that I think... I'm not judging her, but I think that caused some comment, and certainly the documentarians were interested in this footage, given what seemed perhaps like an inappropriate affect. They do recreate the scene, and Reese Witherspoon does a good job kind of bringing it down to a more relatable interaction that doesn't seem quite so... like she's on a bunch of sedatives, I'll just say it. But I think the real life Pam Hobbs, like her life and her relationship with substances, was quite a bit more complicated than what was rendered here. So while I was glad that the movie wasn't condescending to this community, sometimes it felt like they were overcompensating out of fear of not, like, out of fear of accidentally, like, being patronizing to this community.
Yeah. I mean, they do a lot of, like, signaling.
Well, sure.
Like, cross in the rearview mirror, and there's a catfish restaurant, and, you know, going down to the creek.
Yeah.
And all this kind of stuff. But, yeah, it's not as... It could have been worse.
There's
a lot
of
other... bigger issues,
especially that you're dealing with a case that, like, and this was not the only case like this, you know, I could name several others where Satanic Panic like got people convicted based on fuck all, and it's so unbelievable to at least this, you know, relatively cynical Yankee who went to a, you know, UCC Baptist double charter church, and like people came to church in jeans, and it was not, you know, there was no speaking in tongues or any of that, but that this was like a guiding investigation tool for law enforcement at times is like, it boggles the mind. And it's very easy to, I think, shit on people who believed this, and I think it's warranted to shit on people who believed this, especially people in law enforcement. And I think Devil's Knot does a pretty good job not underscoring that too much. But in the clip I'm about to play, please understand that when you hear Colin Firth as Ron Lax in the sort of towards the end of the clip talking, he is looking at a painting in his office of Robert Johnson, who notoriously, the legend has it, sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads for the, you know, for his gift. We fucking get it, movie. Here's clip three.
Community. Satanism is out there, and you must be watchful for the six indicators of satanic involvement. Obsession with death, satanic paraphernalia, kidnapping, sexual abuse, cannibalism, and cremation.
And I believe that there may be others who knew that these three babies were going to be sacrificed. My wife and I are scared. Satan and his demons have already been at work here in West Memphis.
Worship of evil debated as motive in killings.
This article in the West Memphis Evening Times claims that people who knew Damien said he dressed in black and carried a cat skull. Also claims he wears the number 666 inside his boots. And then it goes on to quote two unnamed girls, one who said she seen Damien drink blood, and another who said Damien threatened to cut off a boy's head and put it on a doorstep.
Sounds like energetic young man.
There is definitely a connection between hard metal music and Satanism.
I mean, yeah, hard metal music. Like, you know, we do get it. But here was another spot where it's like, who is this for? Because if we've seen the documentaries and we know the case, this just seems like kind of, you know, we're so much smarter than they are virtue signaling, like you said. And if you don't know the case, you still get it because you've seen movies about trials before. I don't know.
It just seemed, you know, I sound like a broken record, but it just, everything about this movie screamed like just, it's just not good. You know, it's just not well thought through. It treats things on a very superficial level. Like all that satanic stuff. Like there's no real exploration of why like people would believe that or like larger societal. I mean, there's no context for it. It's just these people spouting about it and you're supposed to be like, what an asshole. But to no other purpose, you know, it's just because it had actually happened. We'll throw that in there, but you know, there's not even like the typical sort of take of, you know, if you're different in one of these super conservative towns, then you're vulnerable. Like they don't even get into that. You know,
I mean, they kind of do, and we have a clip of that later. But yeah, you're right. And at the same time, especially early in the film, when the boys are missing but haven't yet been found, and then their bodies are being discovered, there are some visuals that I felt were gratuitous of the bodies of these naked children.
Yes.
Like, and I've seen the actual crime scene photos, and leaving aside the question of whether sort of bearing witness to this kind of horror is something that we should do in order to, you know, remember that it's not just a case, people died, etc., something that we talk about all the time. You know, these are little kids, and there's no reason to show that, especially if you're not even going to talk about the pertinent results of the autopsy that made law enforcement even more likely. Like there was mute genital mutilation that, as it turns out, was probably from wildlife. But that's why law enforcement went to Satanism. They didn't just sort of, you know, they weren't like sitting around workshopping a way that they could assign that motive to some case. It doesn't excuse it, but it's like, if you're going to show us these horrible visuals, why? Are you just like reminding us that this was terrible? Got it. Thanks.
I'm beyond speculating on what the point of any of this stuff was.
I think that there's, I think the film is also highly motivated to sort of marry Sue Ron Lax, who is a real guy and died the year this came out. But this is like, this is some clunky, you know, Basila exposition from his paralegal in clip four, and like, we get it. Ron Lax wants to get to the truth.
Tell those court-appointed lawyers they want me. I'm offering my services.
Pro bono? Are you sure you want to do that, boss? I mean, we have got a lot on our plate right now.
We got that big insurance fraud case. This just isn't the best time to be working for a cause.
You know how I feel about these death penalty cases. It's the least I can do.
I know, but this crime is unthinkable. What if they did it? Have you thought of that?
And what if they didn't? And even if they did, I think three dead kids is enough. I'm on my way.
I feel so bad for that actress.
I know.
Having to say those lines.
I know. And everything is just unthinkable. Pro bono? Should I have a line explaining what that is too? Ugh. It's just really, that is some of the clunkiest writing in a fairly clunky script. Again, Reese Witherspoon is good. Colin Firth is good. His accent is not ridiculous. For whatever reason, British to Southern tends to translate pretty well. He's fine. Kevin Durand is good. But it's just, I pulled a couple other clips, but I don't think I'm going to bother because I just don't know who this is for. And I can't really recommend that anyone watch it because if you don't know the case, this isn't really going to give you the pertinent headlines. And if you do, your teeth are going to be on edge like half an hour into it. So,
there's just, so two things that kind of leapt out at me in addition to everything we've talked about is there's the scene where Reese Witherspoon finds a knife up in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And at least as far as I could tell, there wasn't a whole lot of build up to that. So that when she found it, I was like, yeah, like, for once I do want somebody to like explain through speaking out loud to nobody like what's going on here,
because
I can't remember what the point of that is. So there's like this big climactic scene, but at least for me, I didn't have enough context other than to be like, oh, she found this knife and it clearly means something, but I don't know what.
I just realized that because I was like, either I had been sort of brushing up on the case or just remembered that this was an issue, that she was like going through her husband's toolkit and found her son's Boy Scout knife, it was a pocket knife that I guess her dad gave him. Whatever.
It was weird.
He never didn't have it on him, and it shows up in her husband's toolbox. I think she gave it to the police and they didn't test it. I forget what the actual situation was, but none of this is communicated in the movie. And this is like a watershed moment for this character who presumably is the character that is the through line, or one of them anyway.
Then
she starts to suspect her husband, and then you sort of get chyrons at the end that confirm that he might not have done everything, but he did something. So this movie is a mess, and I bet the director would do it really differently if he had it to do again, but I seem to recall that this was like, this should be on this head Oscar buzz. Hey, Joe Reed, if you're listening, have me on. I've already watched it once and I will talk about this, but I feel like this was going to be a big prestige-y Oscar bait hoo-ha, and it sank for all the reasons that we've said. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the other thing that kind of like, well, there's two things. One is the thing that further complicated the knife scene was that there was like these cobwebs that were quite clearly put in the scene, and it's like, and I was like, am I supposed to feel like nobody's been up there in a while, like, and then how does that relate to the night? It was just bizarre. But the other thing is at the very end,
Reese Witherspoon, those cobwebs were very like
confusing. Behold, for no reason,
cobwebs, like, okay, easy.
The other thing is that at the end, like, Reese Witherspoon kind of gives this like monologue where she basically sums up like all the themes of the movie in like 45 seconds. And it's like, seriously, like, why did you do that? Like, in case like somebody was just walking in at the end of the movie, like you missed the entire like hour and 50 minutes before this, you just like wanted to sum it up in case we missed all of it.
In case you're doing a like report for social studies, here's the Cliff's Notes. Yeah. It's too bad. It's a waste of her. It's a waste of my birthday mate's formidable talents.
Oh, yeah?
It was also a very weird experience. As we're recording this, Big Little Lies came back last night. So I was watching a screener on the plane home from ATX, and having watched Devil's Knot on Saturday and watching Reese in Big Little Lies on Sunday, it was just a very, it was jarring. And yeah. I mean, it's not her fault, this movie. She did what she could, and I think she may have been a producer on it, or like, you know, done some pushing to get it made versus just being cast in it. But yeah, it's just not, you can see glimmers of what it could have been if they had just focused down and not tried to be everything in 2 hours, but that's not what happened. So yeah, this is a skip. Yeah. I'd go with the documentaries instead, or read the book. The book is good.
Or like take a nap for 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just anything.
Yeah, anything. Seriously, graphic novel, watch TV. All right. Well, hopefully the second cold case will have treated us slightly better. I'm not super optimistic, but we'll see what you think. All the Queen's Horses has been on my to-watch list for a while. That one is on Netflix and I think is staying there. Here's the case file. Dixon, Illinois is home to two notorious personages, Ronald Reagan and Rita Crundwell. Crundwell, who weirdly has the same birthday as my husband, was the controller and treasurer of Dixon, Illinois from 1983 to 2012 and the confessed embezzler of $53.7 million over a period of 22 years, primarily in order to finance her championship American quarter horse breeding operation, which, not for nothing, but at least it worked. She was pretty good at the horse thing. She was extremely good at the stealing thing. Anyway, Crundwell was fired in April 2012 after the fraud was finally discovered by accident. She pleaded guilty to her crimes and was sentenced to nearly 20 years in prison, where she remains, as does the stench of negligence over the Dixon municipal government. Had you ever heard of this case before?
No.
I hadn't either, and north of $50 million goes missing.
It's insane.
You'd think. But no, I'd never heard of it either. I had no familiarity with the case. I was pleased after Devil's Knot to see that this was a trim hour and 10 minutes long. But here's the thing. The director is named Kelly Richmond Pope. She's on camera early in the film for a talking head interview. She does the voiceover. She is a professor. And, you know, obviously this is a case that is a preoccupation of hers. And she's like a professor of, I think, accounting. So she understands how to, she understands why it's like important and shocking beyond the obvious. But I mean, she's, let's put on a show. Like, there are aspects of the production that are extremely amateurish. You'll see this in the visual aids, which you'll find on social media. That's Blotter Presents anywhere. But in the closing credits, the word embezzlement is spelled incorrectly. That can't happen. It just can't.
I missed that.
That can't happen. Embezzlement. No, that's not where the L goes. Yeah. This was okay. I don't regret watching it. I didn't feel like it was quite the waste of time Devil's Knot was. But I wouldn't mind seeing someone else take a run at it. It felt a little long. It felt a little first drafty. It didn't, I didn't feel like I got a ton of background on Crundwell. I don't know. What did you think of it overall?
I thought it would have been an awesome, like, 20-minute, 60-minutes piece.
Yeah.
And I think it just, you know, to fill out that hour and 10 minutes or whatever it is, I just... Some of the choices that were made about where to spend time,
yeah,
seemed weird in that, you know, the idea of it is kind of fascinating. It's like, how the hell do you in a fairly small town steal that much money and get away with it? And then the only reason why you ever get caught is just basically laziness. And you know, it wasn't even like she was trying to hide things very much. She just, you know, had another bank account.
Yeah.
And just kept transferring money there. And if she hadn't, instead of giving, like, her admin or her assistant or whatever, like, the list of the accounts that she was supposed to request, and the admin just said, give me all the accounts, it was like, oh, what's that one?
Yeah.
She would have continued going. I mean, it was that kind of thing that got her caught. Like, all the oversight. Like, so... It seemed to me that there's a lot of super interesting stuff going on there, and very little of that stuff actually kind of gets looked at. And so I don't know. I kept watching it. I'm like, why is this? This should be more interesting than it is. And I think part of it is that.
I mean, I think it had all the tools. It just needed to be like taken apart and rebuilt by someone who has a little more experience with just filmmaking. Like, did you watch that series Dirty Money?
I don't think
it's so. It's on Netflix, and it's all about just like, you know, the shitty things corporations do.
Yeah.
One of them is about like the Volkswagen, you know, changing test results about fuel emissions. And another one is like I think the season finale is about, you know, the Trumps. And like Alex Gibney directed one, Aaron Lee Carr directed one. Dan and I like mainlined the thing in 2 days over the winter holidays. And it's, I mean, some of them aren't awesome, but overall it's really good. And I kind of wish this had been in that series so that it would have been under an hour probably, and a sort of known documentarian with a little more just experience who like has a slightly better ear for what's interesting about this case could have taken control of it. Because I agree with you, like, I think this is an interesting case, even though it's, like, fairly straightforward. Like, she just stole a shit ton of money and spent it on horses and a $2 million motor coach and on and on and on. But there's not a whole lot of background on her. There's not a whole lot of, interviews with people who seemed to know her, not in the context of either investigating her or being a confidential informant on her. So yeah,
there's no sense of her at all.
Well, and she think. I mean, she wouldn't cooperate, but like, right. I think most documentarians sort of assume with this kind of subject matter, like your topic, like your subject will be, you know, adversarial, and you're just gonna have to fill in the blanks. And that wasn't necessarily done. I did think they did a good job illustrating the whistleblower's name is Kathy Swanson. This is the woman who, like, Crundwell went on vacation, and Swanson, instead of ordering the list of bank accounts, ordered them all. And then was like, well, that's weird. And it went from there. I thought they did a good job illustrating her predicament. So here's clip 7.
I had to do this for 6 months. I had to keep that status quo in the office. I had to ask her how her trips were, how her dogs were, so as not to let on that something was not right, and I knew about it.
She came to me one morning and she said, I don't know if I can handle this any longer.
My boyfriend Tom would say to me quite frequently, "Are you sure you're okay? Is there anything wrong with your kids? You don't seem like yourself." And I would just say, "Oh, I have a lot of work to do. There's a lot going on at work. I need to get a lot of things done."
That's a perspective that you seldom hear, and I appreciated that was there.
And maybe that would have been the better way to go at it, would have been more like how she got taken down, you know, how this woman who did this fraud was exposed. Because again, it's like even in that little clip, it's like I'd ask her about her trips and her dogs. It's like you don't hear about any of that. Like, unless those trips were taking her show ponies around to win these awards for something. It's weird because I kind of feel like, and I'm basing this on absolutely nothing other than having worked at a university with people who, you know, I mean, that's kind of in the nature of being an academic, is that you find these things that you're intensely interested in and you study the hell out of them. And I kind of feel like she felt like she had to like dress it up a little bit, rather than just focus on the stuff that she found most interesting. And I think that worked to the detriment of the movie. But again, I don't know. It just seemed kind of, it was weird. And it was weird in that there was like these sort of moments of like almost cliched competence. Like she would just do like that clip you just played where she's talking, and you hear the clicking in the background. It's because instead of like showing the woman talking, you have her voiceover while they're showing her at work, like typing something into a computer. It's like,
that's totally a feature of the Blotter True Crime Property Bingo card. They just love to show people typing.
So there's a whole bunch of things like that where instead of showing the person talking, they'll be talking, they'll show that person like walking down the street or, you know, opening mail or whatever it is.
It's a very like tabloid news mag, 48 hours approach to storytelling that I think is like, that's fine for them and we all know what it is, but might not have served this material. I agree.
But if you're a professor, you know, who's making a film, you probably watch a lot of it, be like, "Oh, okay, so this is how you do it, so you look like a pro." But yeah, I don't know. Again, I just kind of felt like when it was over, I was like, why wasn't this just like 15 or 20 minutes?
Yeah. Here's an illustration of what you're talking about. I'm going to skip ahead to clip 9, but like, this is a pretty decent explainer of how she stole the money, of how Grunwell stole the money, and how basically like what a straightforward process it was. There's some like cute little illustrations involving cartoon piggy banks. And then it's marred by like this weird usage that, why didn't somebody tell you to retake that voiceover? Because you'll hear. Here's clip 9.
To get the process started, she created phony invoices to justify payments for imaginary capital projects, such as fixing sidewalks and street repairs. These phony invoices triggered Rita's transferring money from the city's legitimate capital development fund into her secret account. And it had a similar name to look like a legitimate city account. From her secret account, she wrote checks for her personal expenses, such as spa visits, jewelry, real estate, a motor coach, and of course, quarter horses. She did this process 179 times.
I mean, first of all, I just kept thinking of Ferris Bueller, 179 times, but also did this process. Like, nobody wanted to tell the professor to just retake that. Repeated this process, underwent this process, repeated these actions. Like, that just makes no sense. I don't know. But this is the movie. I think she's actually a pretty good like explainer, and her voiceover is very welcoming. But it just needed some rewrites, and there are little like amateurish bits in there that made it, you know, that and misspelling embezzlement that just made it a little hard to take seriously. And then once they get into like the town having post-traumatic stress about the fact that this went on for over two decades, and that auditors didn't find it and the IRS didn't find it, and basically it took this one trigger, and then she kind of convicted herself because she had kept meticulous records and hidden them in her house, because, you know, criminal's gonna criminal. That's where the movie really kind of lost me, that I just didn't think that was a good use of the time versus exploring Crundwell herself and her background and, you know, why this might have happened. I didn't really need to hear from the new council people after this incident. So,
yeah, I mean, nice try, but it just, you know, it seems like if she just hired a professional just to like look at an early cut and give some thoughts,
yeah,
it would have been helpful.
Or just like someone to proofread it and be like, this locution is a little clanky. I was sort of taken by the fact that after she was like able to do this apparently repeatedly and was like steadily stealing more and more, that she just thought she would provide a complete accounting of it in this way that's like, whenever this happens in the movies where it's like, I have a second set of books in a safe that confirms that I'm evil, like, no one actually does that shit.
Right.
Well, Crundwell did. Here's clip 8.
During a search warrant of her multiple properties, the two homes in Dixon, the horse farm also in Dixon that she owned, conducted on the day she was arrested and interviewed, we found located in the basement, crawl space of her home, boxes of every record. And she kept very good records of her fraud. It helped to see the scope of what she took, what did she do with the money. And in 91 was when she took her first money, which was about $181,000 that year. But we were able to figure that out because of the records she kept and stored in her house.
The records that she kept and stored in her house.
Bookkeeper is going to bookkeep.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Like, sometimes they catch themselves. Really this time. Yeah, there's a lot here, and there are references to other cases that I wonder if there are also documentaries on. I find this kind of thing, even if it's a little bit sort of Byzantine in the plotting, which it always is, I do find it interesting. But at the end of the day, either it's like the way that she was stealing was so straightforward that I'm overthinking it, or they don't quite explain how she justified the expenses. Did you feel like you had a grasp on how, like, during a recession year, she's able to steal over $5 million? Because I feel like I don't. Either I'm missing something, or it's just that she just took it. And everyone was like, okay.
Yeah, I don't, you know, actually having, like, been in local government to a certain degree, like, it boggles my mind to think that that could happen in my town, which is maybe a third the size of that town. But if somebody stole $1.7 million from the budget, like, there'd be no hiding it, you know? And if you're like, well, it's for the, you know, the sidewalk on Elm Street, you know, people be like, there's no sidewalk project on Elm Street. Like, I don't know. I can't see that happening in my community, which makes me wonder, like, how that, you know, how could, like, was just nobody at all was paying to any attention. Like, the way the budget gets scoured by our town council, like, is ridiculous. And apparently that was just never happening at all.
Yeah, and where does the money even come from? Like, I'm from a town that, like Dixon, Illinois, is basically, like, run, you know, from mayor to council to whatever. It's, like, less than 20,000 people. And that's like a weekend, night and weekend job for which they barely get paid. Same as Dixon. Like, all these people have day jobs, right? So I can see them not necessarily paying that close attention, but this is also a community of, like, a lot of Wall Street schmucks who can see when this kind of thing is happening because they see it every day. So I just, like, I don't understand where the money is coming from. Like, I understand that she squeezed things out of the budget so that there would be more left over, that she's like, all right, well, if we tweeze like 30 grand out of the, I don't know, EMT retraining, for example, then she would take that money. But where was that money coming from in the first place? Like, in the middle of Illinois in 2009?
Yeah.
I mean,
I
get it happened, so I guess it must have come from somewhere, but it's also like, how, like, what were they getting, like, federal matching funds to do, like, public works projects that she then just was like, well, nope, we can't afford it, and then she bought a horse? I'm not a stupid person.
Those questions are unanswered.
I just don't
understand. Those questions are not addressed.
No, they're not really. Yeah, this was, I mean, it was fine for the first half, and in the second half it wandered. But yeah, I wanted it to be better, but, like, per interest over minutes, per minute, this is superior to Devil's Knot, I would say, and still available for free. So you don't have to commit to a $3 rental. Just start watching it, and if you're not into it, you can quit. And
that's right.
If you can explain to me where this little town was even getting $5 million a year for her to steal, people in the Illini municipal government infrastructure, please reach out. Like I said, at Blotter Presents across all social media. Toby, I'm sorry that the 100th episode of All Cold Cases was not quite the cavalcade of thrills to which you've become accustomed here on the Blotter Presents.
Yeah. Hopefully our analysis was the cavalcade of thrills.
Well, we try.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's stick a fork in this. Toby, you and I and Julian Gross have another podcast coming up. Would you like to tell the listeners a little bit about what that's going to be?
Yeah, it's called Accomplice in the Wood Chipper. It's going to be taking a look at neo-noir movies, mostly from the 90s, but also, I think, going back to the 80s. Yeah, so we recorded the first episode, and I am working on, production as we speak, or not actually as we speak, but maybe as you listen to this out there in audience land. And it should be pretty fun. We start off with The Last Seduction, and it was Julian's idea to look at these movies as a group. And it was a lot of fun recording the first one. Do you have any thoughts, Sarah?
Not really. It really was fun recording the first one. I think our next topic is Shallow Grave.
Yes.
So yeah, we have like a whole list of 90s neo-noir movies and, you know, whatever the previous version of Beyond is. And I'm pretty excited for that to reach the light of day. So stay tuned.
Sometime this summer. Yep.
Awesome. Toby, thanks for celebrating the centennial episode with me.
It was a gala night.
Well, it was a night anyway. Didn't we have a time?
One part of that, right?
Yeah. All right. Coming up on The Blotter Presents. Next time, it's first-time guest Omar Gayaga on the Cameron Todd Willingham case and others. And after that, we've got Kevin Smokler on 16 Shots and Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That is Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter, as well as Instagram. You can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/Blotter Presents, and subscribe to that newsletter, blotterpresents.substack.com. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so that other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell anyone. My guest has been Toby Ball. He's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.